Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, and this is Insight is Capital. Over the past decade, global equity leadership has become increasingly concentrated. Today, roughly 70% of the MSCI World Index is allocated to U.S. equities. That level of dominance reflects extraordinary performance, but it also raises an important question about capital concentration and future return expectations. At the same time, we're seeing signs of stress at the margins, narrow market breadth, elevated valuations in select segments, and renewed debate around the durability of U.S. dollar strength. Our guest today, Cole Smead, CEO and portfolio manager at Smead Capital Management, has suggested that what we're witnessing may not simply be a valuation cycle, but a capital flow cycle. Historically, when capital becomes heavily concentrated in one geography, eventual rebalancing can influence currencies, commodities, and relative equity performance in meaningful ways. He has also spoken about what he calls a post-frackers world, a shift in the structure of energy production that could reprice long-lived oil assets, particularly in North America, and what that means in the Canadian oil patch. So this conversation is not just about stock selection. It's about regime shifts. Are we approaching an inflection point in U.S. market leadership? Is the dollar entering a structurally different phase? And how should investors think about international equities, Canadian energy equities, commodities, and long-duration growth assets if capital flows begin to rebalance?
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Cole, welcome. It is great to have you back on the show. Thank you for joining me.
Pierre, thanks for having me. Really good to see you.
It's great to catch up with you again. It's been quite a while, and I was really excited leading up to our date here today. It's great to have you. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here. It's been quite a start to 2026. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of chaos geopolitically. There's been some retrenchment recently in the market, some significant retrenchment in the market, which is all providing some signals that things are fragmenting, things are recalibrating. Money is in rotation. And so before we get into our broader conversation, I'm curious to get your take on what you're seeing, what's happening so far this year.
Yeah, it's a great question. So let's see, this will be a little bit of a shameless plug for a talk I gave recently, but I'm going to be giving it up in Canada. Shout out to the CFA Society of Edmonton coming up here in April. I'll be giving this talk to. I've been giving a talk that's called Manias in American CapEx Cycles. Okay? Because I think it really does a good job of walking through the past instances. Newsflash, everyone. This is a normal part of capitalism. It's really depressing to say that, by the way. It's normal. This is all normal. There's nothing that's not standard about this, okay? It's just, you can't ever know how these things build up, and you don't ever get to know how they end up playing out. So in that talk, we look back at the railroad mania of the 1880s, okay? I keep on telling folks this, but you're at a cocktail party, let's say, they're in the suburbs of Toronto, and someone comes to you and says, hey, all these railroads went bankrupt at one point. I wonder if any of them did. And you look back and say, Illinois Central, my friend. The Illinois Central never went bankrupt, okay? So that's the only one. It's the only one we can find that didn't go bankrupt, okay? So I say that because people often forget that, history never repeats itself, but it rhymes. And these paradigms often follow similar bounds, not for the same reasons, not with the same people, not with the same purpose, but they follow similar paradigms. We also looked at the telecom bust of the late 1990s. We also look at the fracking bust of the 2010s, okay?
Right.
And as you look across those, the commonalities that you see are new technologies arrive that kind of excite the passions, if you will. Railroads, it was like the Westinghouse air brake, which was a phenomenal transformation then. In the telecom business, it was just the internet itself, the fact that we can use the internet through fiber and other means to connect. And then obviously in the oil business, it was fracking and all these technologies that came forward in that process. Today, it's AI, okay? And so, again, those are all commonalities. What else do you find is interesting? CapEx. CapEx just tends to be massive and massive. The question is, what's the money going to be made after? Okay. Now, without, you know, giving my thoughts on today's instance, here's the one thing we have found. Most people will make the argument, well, here's the deal, Pierre. Here's the deal, Cole. There's going to be one of these companies that are going to just do something that's mind-blowing, and it's going to be a winner-take-all game. And it's kind of like if you buy that, they go up so much, the others can do poorly, and you don't care. That's not what history argues is the issue. If you look at the railroad businesses from, say, 1890 to, you know, 110 years later, they didn't do better than the average stock. If I look at just the first 20 years of that, they produced a subpar return to the average stock. If I look at the telecoms, AT&T and Verizon were the winners. They weren't Nortel. They weren't Lucent. They weren't WorldCom. They weren't Global Crossing. But they only made 5% for 25 years. If I look at the fracking world, if you look at the oil companies from, say, the high in 2014, it was a mid-single-digit game in terms of returns. And right. So the main question for investors is, are those the kind of returns that will fit your needs? If they are, God bless you. We tip our cap to you. Have a wonderful day. You sound like you're too rich anyway. for our investors, that's not good enough for them. And it's not good enough for me as one of those investors either. And really where we've seen the change begin, we can talk more about this if you want, but since November 1st, we've seen an inflection take place. Our investors have been getting rewarded over the last 90 days, and or I should say 120 days in that case. And so that feels much better. It was getting very unenjoyable, particularly on the U.S. equity side. And so we're very excited that this is going on. And, you know, things like construction in progress being a question in the accounting of these businesses, things of that nature, that we're going to find out real quick that U.S. GAAP accounting is where you start, or IFRS is where you start as an analyst. That's not where you end up. And you need to derive what you need to determine out of what they're telling you.
100%. Like investors are both, you know, there's a sort of pressure on investors right now to make certain decisions because, you know, a lot of investors think that they're participating in these kinds of opportunities by owning index funds. Mm-hmm. They believe they're diversified by owning index funds. But really, all that's happening is that they're just automatically gaining exposure to the market. There's no selectivity going on. But I think to your point, like one of the things that has really changed in the last 190, 120 days is that dispersion has come back in the market.
Yep.
Where the market is starting to pick apart the components of indexes. The market is starting to pick apart market structure and look at capitalization and different factors across the market. And really, like sort of one of the winning factors, of course, more recently has been quality and value.
Yeah.
And because so much of the increase that we've seen, it's wonderful that we've had, you know, this booming stock market for the last 3 years straight and longer. And I just say the last 3 years because 2022 was the anomaly.
Yeah.
Was one of the anomalous years in the last, but it was really a wake up call. And we're seeing a real structural shift. I mean, I recall something like three years ago or 4 years ago, people were saying markets like Europe were uninvestable.
Yeah.
China was uninvestable. I'm not making a call by saying that, but these markets were uninvestable just a few short years ago. And because of all the political chaos that we've had in the last year, that has motivated structural change in the form of fiscal spending, for example, in Europe, and towards defense tech, defense tech, for example.
Sure.
That's exciting to hear, Cole. I'm excited for you because it's your thesis. It's your thesis that's finally getting a real serious footing.
Well, there
once
is.
Again, after that very long period of index dominance.
Yeah. Think about it like this. So let's say we were having this conversation last April. OK, Okay, so last April, that period, just so interesting. From an investment perspective, I love mentally going back to those periods and thinking deeply about them. Okay, so
this is the Liberation Day period.
The Liberation Day period, okay? And, you know, if you go back, and you know, I wrote a piece last spring called, it was called OILS, Oil Stocks, okay? That was the title of the piece. Sounds very matter-of-fact. It is very matter-of-fact, okay? But here's the case I made. I used history as my guide. In 1981, we had very high inflation and very high interest rates in America. And so if you look at the dead flat bottom of the bear market, it was 81. Well, 3 years later, after not only the effects of Paul Volcker, but Ronald Reagan doing things like standing down the air traffic controllers and really trying to break the back of union labor, 3 years later, what had happened is the economy had taken off, you know, in the early 1980s. And by 84, people were like, wow, the economy's humming. Inflation must be coming back. And so what there was a retest of the low of the bond market in 1984. And the question the bond investor had to ask back then is, do I bet against the idea that inflation's coming back and I take up yields that seem insane for this period of time? Now, were they as good as 1981? No, but you had to believe that inflation would get broken then. So that took real courage. In 84, it took wisdom, okay? Mm-hmm. And so I used that picture of the bond market between 81 and 84 as an analogy to what was happening last spring in the oil market, okay? The dead flat low, my lifetime low in the oil market was the spring of 2020. That was the dead flat low of my life in the oil business, okay? So last spring, were we seeing exactly the same kind of depravity as we saw in the spring of 20? No, we didn't see negative oil prices. We didn't see companies needing to see if they're going to make it through the storm, et cetera. None of that. But was it painful? Did those stocks get crushed? Did they have political rhetoric that added to the fire and the conflagration that was going on around those stocks? Did people believe that we were going to have a recession off the back of this tariff tantrum and all this stuff? It wasn't like having courage in the spring of 20. It was like having wisdom in 84 to know that this was not that big of a deal and you had a great opportunity to go out and add to what you had in the space, and no one perceived that. That was the second best buying opportunity of the last 25 years in the oil business. And you know what? Very few people took advantage of that, okay? And I just point that out because that's what markets allow for. Markets don't instruct you. They serve you. So to your point about what's been going on more recently in the U.S. equity market space, there have been a lot of people very foolishly, in my opinion, in our opinion, going out and saying, well, here's what's going on in the stock market. What is this telling us about the future? And that is not the obligation of the market. It is not the scrutineer, if you would, like they have in proxies. They're not scrutineering the market. They are just telling you what the stock price is, and you are there to be the scrutineer, and you are there as the analyst to go out and ask, how do I take advantage of the current circumstances? And I think what this boils up to is one of the myths that we're going to prove wrong in this era of, say, U.S. stock dominance or U.S. stock participation. As I think about it, it's the largest foreign ownership of U.S. stocks ever has been what's going on recently, okay?
Right.
And so we're going to find out really quickly that this idea that the passive investment is going to make the underlying human who has this proclivity to buy high and sell low, and that's what they're really, really good at, by the way, is buying high and selling low. They aren't going to be any better investor than the guy in 1950 or the gal in 1980. It's not going to change. It's not different this time. And we're going to find out really what the intestinal fortitude of the common stock investor in U.S. equities are, which most people perceive to be that they will go unscathed and they won't be bothered by, to your point, of any regime change. I think that's foolish. I think that's fantasy. We think that's foolish and fantasy. But again, that's one of the theories we're going to get to test. Was all this behavioral analysis and reading Kahneman and Tversky and, you know, thinking of like type one, type two errors and what our biases are, is that actually going to change the average participation of the average investor? I do not believe so. And we're going to get to see that petri dish tested in the open markets the next few years.
Yeah. Cole, one of my one of my favorite quotes of all time is, in the long run, stocks return to their rightful owners.
Correct. That's a great line.
Right. And, you know, there's going to be, you know, when a, you know, that sort of cataclysmic next shakeout comes in the market, that's exactly what's going to happen. Right. And that's to your point. Last year, last April, was a generational buying opportunity, given all the chaos that was fomented by the White House. You know, it's amazing always, and you know, it's just like when, you know, people look at stocks like Google, for example, or Alphabet, and you know, they'll say things like, you know, at a cocktail party, they'll say things like, well, you know, if that happens again, if Alphabet stock drops 50-60%, you know, or more, I'm in.
But it's easy to say right? that. It's a totally different thing.
Very
to do
easy.
That. It's always, it's cliche. It's like, you know.
That's it. I mean, it happened with Meta just a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Right?
Here's how I think about it. Like, it's like when people quote Buffett. I'm a big fan of Buffett. I think the world of what he's taught us. I think I'm a massive Charlie Munger fan. You know, his ability to cut through to things, I think, is one of the most superb spiritual gifts I've ever seen encompassed in a human. Okay. Now, I say all that because I hear people quote Buffett and Munger all the time. Now, whether they actually do or understand what it even means, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny, you know. I, you know, people used to wonder like why I would speak so freely about, you know, how I was marketing as an advisor, or how I was, you know, bringing in new clients, or what my, what my technique was, what my unique selling proposition was, and you know, they would say like, why are you giving away like your secrets? So, because they're not secrets, you know. You don't know what's behind what I do. You don't know what's involved in what I do. I'm telling you what I do, but for you to replicate it is a whole other story.
Yeah,
right. I know that's a personal anecdote, but when you know, there's historically this incredible amount of intelligence that Warren Buffett has shared with investors through, you know, letters, annual letters and books, that profile his style. No amount of reading those, you know, about those techniques, that investing prowess is going to make you be able to replicate that. You have to come up with your own program, your own process for doing that. You can't just go out in the market and say, well, I like this, but yeah, the point I was going to make about, you know, like the Meta example, 3 years ago now, 2 years or 3 years ago, Meta stock was down 65%, and nobody was backing up the truck.
Yeah.
Nobody was saying, I'm going to pick it up. I'm, you know, the stock's down 65% from its peak. I'm going to start buying it.
Yeah.
The only people who were in there actually buying it deliberately were short sellers. You know, getting squeezed.
Covering their short.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's funny, you know, one of the questions we got, you know, I'll use the 2022 fall off in some of those stocks, but also let's use the SaaSpocalypse of what's been going on recently, okay?
Right.
Here's a, you know, we've been getting questions around, have you guys been doing any work in that space? The answer is, I mean, anytime stocks get bludgeoned, like we're somewhere around there doing our digging, doesn't mean we're going to find anything to invest in, but we're going to be, we like contentiousness. We like disagreement. That's how you get good security prices, is you find disagreement. So let me just give you, I'll give you kind of a simple example of this. As we look across the space, why, you know, the lot of the SaaS business should be naturally interesting to folks is that they are asset-light businesses, a.k.a. you don't need a lot of capital to run the business. So I think those are fortes of the business just without knowing anything. But as you go across the space, what's perturbing is, yeah, you might not have a lot in the capital structure, right? There's not much debt in it. So therefore, even if you count any debt, it's still very asset light. What's weird is if you look at the multiples these businesses have just come off of, and if you look at where the returns on capital are, the returns on capital aren't very high, okay? Now, that doesn't mean every single one of them are like that. But again, we're trying to look and say, okay, we want to understand the business. We want to look at the returns on capital. We want to look at the capital structure. We want to ask what price we're paying for all this in combination with each other. And what's weird is, you know, can I find businesses that are non-tech that produce 20% return on invested capital? Those are out there. They don't have to be tech companies to do that. What's weird? When you find tech companies that are producing less than 20% return on invested capital. And there's quite a few of them. And these are stocks that are coming off trading at 6 to 8 or 10 times their invested capital. What do I think has gone on to a certain extent? The idea of asset light got perverted with high returns on capital. That was a perversion. In other words, oh, you're asset light. You fit the rule of 40, like they talk about in the VC nomenclature, where your revenue growth plus your EBITDA margins or some other form of gross margin is higher than 40. So you're like a cool kid, okay? Now, I've always told people they call it the rule of 40. Why don't they call it the law of 40? The answer is because it's not a law. It's not eternal. We can't live our lives by it. It was a rule for a season is how I think about it. So that's been weird. It's interesting to see investors, you know, again, scrutinizing who is going to benefit from that tumult. Because if you do produce good returns on capital, what do you want to be doing at a time like now? Buying back your stock heavily because your returns on capital allow you to do so. One other thing that I would just casually throw out there for the work we've done in some of those spaces. I had a friend who will go unnamed for the purpose of the podcast. And he ran into the CEO of ServiceNow, Bill McDermott. And Bill has been in the tech business for a long time, and he's got his own personality, and he'd be a very fun person to be at a cocktail party with, I think. And my friend ran into him at a hotel at a conference, and he asked him what's going on with SaaS Apocalypse. And Bill McDermott said, it's the epitome of stupidity in a very thick New York accent, which is kind of funny. Now, he said that. Here's the catch. Go look across the whole SaaS business, and I want you to go ask how much insider buying is going on right now. Where are the insiders? The old saying is, you know, where your money is, your heart is. And what's perturbing to us is we love insider buying. We love to see that in companies we own. We love to see it on companies we don't. So we might go look at them for the first time. There is a dearth of insider buying going on across the SaaS businesses. Now, one question comes up, why? Why is there a dearth of buying going on among the insiders? My pet theory, and again, if you want to email Pierre and say, hey, here's a better theory, Cole, I'm all ears. Again, I'm a learner. So my pet theory is if you look at these businesses, the reason why their returns on capital are not as good as they should be is because stock-based comp is so large at these businesses that we would reduce the free cash, let's just say, by stock comp to get what the actual returns are. And when you do that, the one pet theory you might come up with is these executives and employees have been lavished with so much money from the stock comp over the years that why would they buy in the open market? They know the shareholders will have to give them stock anyway, so why buy it? Okay. And the question is that the right incentive? So again, we'll see. Doesn't mean they're all like that. I'm just speaking general across the space. That is the theory we're working on right now. And I would just say that has caused us to be very, we're just less interested in the space until we see the insider stepping in and speaking, you know, not their mind and with their mouth, but with their money.
I love that that perspective, Cole, because, you know, like I think when you have the kind of sort of fundamental, you know, bottom-up research footing that you have, you know, you can look at a sector, you can look at an individual company, and you can tear it apart, and you can find, you know, you can find out that even, you know, amongst the debris of these companies right now, that there are, you know, there are deal breakers in there, you know. And like Shark Tank, you can say, and for that reason, I'm out.
And that's a really good point. We didn't mention this earlier, but you should think about this era, too. Let's just step back, okay?
Yeah.
You know, Buffett has talked a lot about, you know, he's a big baseball fan, okay? I played college baseball. There's a reason why I'm in the investment business, just so we're all on the same page here, because I was not good enough to play anything better than that. So, but I'm a baseball degenerate too. So for example, I watched the entire 7-game series with Toronto and the Mariners.
Oh yeah.
I'm a Diamondbacks fan. I used to live in Seattle. I'm not a Mariners fan. It's a whole other story. But that was a great series. I was so glad the Blue Jays won, etc. So it's like an at bat. Okay, pitch comes. Is it a fat pitch? Is it in the sweet spot of where you're likely to drive the ball gap to gap or out of the park? If it's not, you have to be thinking about the odds you get paid on your risks. And if you're not getting paid good enough odds in this business, no one's got a gun to your head telling you you have to swing. And what you there and start to think about over time are, how can I benefit myself from staying away from things, like staying away from the low and outside pitch that I shouldn't be swinging at, or the pitch in my eyes that's up in the zone that I have trouble hitting? How do you stay away from things? Most of a good investment discipline just keeps you out of doing things that are stupid. It's a negative art in that respect. So again, back to our discussion with those businesses. Okay, I'm not gonna, I don't care whether it's asset light. I don't care if they don't have any debt. I'm not gonna overpay for a business if they don't have returns that merit overpaying right. for that business. And we've seen that pretty commonly across the space. Now, one higher level thought that I don't get, and I'll give you an example, and we have some touches this business. But I'll use Workday. Let's just use Workday as a very successful SaaS business, okay? Workday they dominate HR SaaS. Okay, across schools, across corporations, they have very funny advertisements. You know, they have all the rock stars and Eddie Money and all those folks, and they're just—it's great advertising. I think it's a great business. And what's perturbing to me is, why doesn't it run higher returns on capital? It dominates the area, and the question is, there just might be too many people and too much bloat. That's one thing. Or we might learn that the asset light era, where you could over earn on returns on capital, is gone. Because if you're asset light and there's tons of capital circling out asset light opportunities, what are you likely to see? Returns are not going to be what they were in the past for asset light businesses. I think there are attractive return businesses out there, frankly, and we've been doing a lot of work on some that we think are of merit. But to your point, it's just so interesting to watch that play out in the bigger cap names in the technology land. Again, the perception is you have to own those in some respects. I mean, we see managers right. in the value space. The largest holding in the Russell 1000 value is Google, okay? The largest holding, okay? So it's like, you know, the secret to life is weak competition. If someone else wants to own that right now at these prices, God bless them. You can have all you want of that stock. You know, we have no interest in touching it right now. But I just say that because part of your alpha can often come from things doing poorly. So when those things go down and people recognize they shouldn't have owned them, if you didn't own them, you get alpha because you didn't lose any money in those situations.
Right. Well, that goes to this idea that, you know, like when, like I like the discussion around, you know, great companies versus great stocks.
Sure.
Like, there's no doubt that companies like Alphabet, Meta, Microsoft, Nvidia, you know, the leader today, are great companies that have done some incredibly exciting things.
I agree.
And are destined to continue to do so for the most part. But that does not mean that the returns, that your return expectations are going to be based on that greatness, because they're, you know, in some cases, they're priced for perfection.
Well, the one thing we're subject to on this earth throughout our lives, which we hate having to adapt to, is the word called change. So let me give you two interesting ways to think about that. IBM used to be a great business in the minds of people. It was a truly great business. It was one of the 10 largest market caps in the world in 1980. Okay, 10 years later, it was still one of the 10 largest market caps in the world. Why? Because it started off so big. I mean, it's like it just, you know. And I point that out because what is great in our minds is changing, and it's changing all the time. And the nifty.
Yeah, and the point is simply that just because a company is great doesn't mean it's going to be a great stock.
I agree. So here's a funny one. Like, so we think, oh, that's great. In the Nifty 50, there was a company called Simplicity Patterns, and they made the sewing kits that ladies would use to sew back then. Now, if you go back and look, Simplicity Patterns made high returns on capital. Okay, it was a good business because how much does it cost to print sewing patterns? I mean, come on, what a great business. Okay, now did it have high returns on capital? Yes. Was it way overpriced? Yes. What was its actual risk? Change is always afoot. And so I just point that out because, you know, if someone says, like, let's use Google since you brought it up. In my life, if someone told me that Google went from 98% of the market search business, or, you know, that share of market search, to 92% in 18 months, I'd say, what in the heck is happening in this world? How did Google lose 6% of their share of search in 18 months? Well, there's one reason. It's called ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. Now, again, I would have never bet on that in my life that Google would lose any search business, frankly. And so here's, again, pet theory, okay? Why are these incumbents in dominant places like the productivity software that Microsoft provides to all of our businesses, or in the search business that Google dominates, or, you know, in their case, also content with YouTube, or in the case of Amazon, where they dominate retail and the hosting business, you know, or Meta, where they dominate social media. Why are these incumbents, these quote-unquote great businesses, why are they so willing to spend so much money in this new avenue of AI? I think we believe that they think their core business in the long run is going to be going bye-bye, which is why right. they have to reinvest this today, because they're more worried about waking up 30 years later and they've been competed away from. And so again, if I go to most people using large language models, in full disclosure, as you guys can probably tell, I'm out on X, so I've used Grok a lot. I've also recently started using Claude. I actually marginally preferred Claude at times. I've done some fun stuff with that. But I just say it because most people that touch any of that, they're not using it for actual real projects. It's glorified search, back to the Google point.
Right.
Okay. And what you'll see is there's no advertising. There's no advertising. That's a big problem for Google.
That's a huge problem, yeah.
So I think the question is, where, you know, what change is afoot? And the real danger, back to your prior point, when you overpay for a business, you tend to underestimate the future change. That's one of the real dangers of way overpaying for businesses, even with good returns on capital. And I think if I was going to give you the simple math that we use in our abacuses here in the office, is that most investors are assuming that these investments are making in AI CapEx, you know, that they're going to make the same returns on capital the past. And I think the logical error that people will run into, and I don't think the AI models would disagree with me on this if I ran into it right now and asked it, is that when you move from an asset-light business to a capital-intensive business, the returns only ever go down. That's the nature of the beast.
It makes a lot of sense. It makes a great deal of sense because, you know, when ChatGPT came out, the infrastructure at the outset was very small, relatively small. They had no way of knowing at that moment that it was going to explode.
Yeah.
That they were going to have 100 million users in a month and or whatever the time frame was. It was the fastest adoption among consumers of a new technology, a new platform, right? And but obviously since that time and since, you know, AI has started to split the market because of you know, this new productivity that it's bringing and this new search capability that it's bringing, for example, that you just talked about, all the companies that are the leaders in the space are trying to get their own foothold in it as quickly as they can. And therefore, you know, that's why we have this planned CapEx of $600 billion in AI over the, you know, over the coming year.
Yeah.
And so when you look at that and you think, well, they're spending the money, they're spending the capital. Outside of the, you know, controversy of the circular capital cycle that some companies have been criticized for, who are the beneficiaries of that largesse, right? And that's where you want to look because those companies are the ones that are going to get the lucre of that spending.
So let's go back to the CapEx discussion from the past. Okay, so if someone says, Cole, you know, how do you and your investors think about the benefit? What's the benefit of all this? Who wins? Okay. Did it help the U.S. economy to build railroads to the West? Yes. Did it help consumers and businesses? Yes. Did it help the investors of railroad stocks or people that bought fixed income bonds and debentures from those railroads? No. They were the losers. Telecoms. You know, who are the winners? The consumer and the economy won again. Who are the losers? The investors. Go look at the oil era of, you know, say the mid-2010s on. Winners, American consumers, the economy. Losers, the investors. Now, here's, again, this is like, you got to remember, we're in a mania. We're coming off, and we're kind of beginning what I'll argue is the hangover period of the mania. And there will be bear market rallies, just so we're on the same page. 2 days ago, just, you know, here we are recording this on the Friday, on Wednesday, that felt like a bear market rally. It's like everybody in the tech stack, whether you're in the Bitcoin world, whether you're in tech, you're in any of those businesses, they're all like, hey, you know what, everybody, that whole regime change, it ain't happening. We got the band back together. No, it's party on. You know, it's like Wayne's World, like game on, right? And, and here we sit 2 days later, and what's going on? The slide that's going on in those businesses is continuing, not dissimilar to what it's been doing, you know, off and on, you know, like you said, for about 120 days. And so, you know, bear market rallies happened from 0 to 0 to 03 when tech fell off too. Now, here's what's interesting. Who made the CapEx in 99? Well, that was 99-2000 was the telecoms. Did Microsoft have to make the CapEx back then? No. Did Amazon make the CapEx back then? No. But all those businesses benefited from the CapEx foolishness of others. Interestingly, their stock prices got tied up in the mania, so it was tough to like go out and buy them to benefit from the telecom CapEx. But when you're Google and you go public in 04, you didn't have to build the internet. You didn't have to pay all that money and waste all that capital. You just have to create a great search engine for the world to use. You eventually go into advertising, which means you got all these benefits from what other people had wasted money on gratis. And so we've been talking a lot about, you know, some of these SaaS businesses, if these AI hyperscalers, you know, are foolish in this, which we think they are, you know, 3 or 4 years later, when you're buying these at really good prices and they've cleaned up the companies to where they're running higher returns on capital, they will be directly benefiting from the AI hyperscalers pissing money away, in our opinion.
Yeah. It reminds me of the post-tech wreck period where, you know, all of that excessive build out of fiber optic networks, you know, laying of undersea cable that wrapped the planet, I don't know how many times over, with fiber optic networking cable. And then it went dark.
Yeah.
You know, or it never got lit up in the first place. You had WorldCom, Global Crossing.
Yeah.
Bankruptcies, freakouts, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
You know, they went to zero. And What always amazes me is because at the time I was involved in sort of going around and talking to advisors about India, and that was sort of the sort of nascent period of heavy, you know, outsourcing to India. But it turns out that the Indian companies, Tata Telecommunications for one, was one of the biggest buyers of that dark fiber in the bankruptcies.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, to your point, the consulting businesses there in India were going to boom off the proliferation of technology tied to the implementation of compute and the internet across American enterprises, for example.
Yeah. So the, you know, Indian businesses came along and said, hey, guess what? All that stuff you've been doing for a dollar, we can do it for 15 cents.
Correct.
Right. And we don't have to be there. We can do it from here. And because we're connected at, you know, at light speed through these fiber optic networks that we've just lit up.
Yeah. When I think there's another thing, again, you know, we're trying to kind of sort this out. But here's if you talk to someone inside technology today, inside the technology industry and ecosphere, and or they're in VC or whatever, they will tell you the things they're doing are remarkable. And by the way, they are. For the record, they are. Okay. That's totally right. They're being totally honest in that. Now, here's the catch. Your agency decides the value of these tools, okay? You're a high agency person. You work at a company that's rolled this out enterprise-wide, and it's a value to the employees that are using it. It's going to have great use. If you're a low agency person, again, your starting point might be glorified search. That doesn't change labor productivity, okay? And so the hope and belief is that the intelligence of the machine, aka the AI large language model, will cause the human to become a lot more intelligent. Well, it might give them information at their fingertips, but you can't make the human more intelligent. They either are or aren't, or they're learning, and therefore it's going to be a paradox where the agency of the person decides the value of AI, and that is no dissimilar to, like, think of how long it took some businesses to go to the internet and go build a website and things like that. The time function, and much like here we sit today with still very, you know, cheap oil and gas prices relative to history on an inflation-adjusted basis, the one thing that the internet had to deal with is our internet's very cheap today. Well, guess what? They thought the demand was going to go up so much, so quick, that the price would be very high and squeeze it. And that's not what happens in technology paradigms. The proliferation of a technology always drives prices lower. And so compute will go down in cost, and chips will go down in cost. Go look at what you can buy a great computer for today, just as an example of that. And people are in this fantasy that these products will stay high priced and thus margins will stay high forever. And, based on looking at Hewlett Packard's business today, it doesn't seem to be that the prices are going to stay high and the business is going to stay great forever. And people forget that these are going to follow the past paradigms and curves of past technological changes.
So, Cole, if I remember, I recall our conversation about LEDs, LED lighting.
Yep.
And how, its proliferation, for example, in automobiles.
Yeah.
Right. And your point then was that as the price of these, these technologies, these innovations falls, and they become increasingly ubiquitous, right? So if the price of technology and the price of these services is going to fall precipitously, does our demand increase along with that? Do we end up buying more? Like, do we buy, instead, if the price of computers, which is getting lower and lower for better and better technology, do we end up buying more, or do we just buy, do we buy more capacity? I don't know if we're backing up the truck for more computers, but as the price of memory falls, the price of networking falls, we do want faster internet, for example. Like, as the price of internet falls, somebody comes along and says, well, you've got that 1.5
yeah.
service. Now for the same price, you can have the 3.0.
Yeah, it's like he says in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It's that competition,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So to your point, there's something called the Jevons Paradox. If you've never
right.
looked this up before, it's a wonderful framework thing. And I will throw out one other resource to your listeners. If you ever want to say, hey, how do I get more framework thinking in my life, which is something I've done over the years, and there's a killer event called COSM. I'm involved with it, but it's a technology conference, and these things come up from a framework. What's the framework we need to think about how to study and judge the future of the world, knowing that we can't predict the future, but we have these old frameworks to deal with? So William Stanley Jevons was a British economist, and at the time, the coal revolution, of the Industrial Revolution was dominated by the UK. But, you get the James Watt steam engine, which was coal-fired, and this comes about. And so people conjectured, oh, coal prices are going to go to the roof, and there's going to be a scarcity. And Jevons said, no, because what happens is the use of the technology grows, supply is created by its own demand. In other words, over time, you'll have competitive forces come in, and you will greatly use more of it, but it will meet its own needs, was what Jevons argued. And so what happened off that? We found coal in a lot of other places, and therefore the technology proliferated, the energy source for it proliferated. Okay? So using that in today's world, you can look at computers, you can look at a gallon of gas. There's a bunch of products you can look at. A really good book out there is called Superabundance by Gail Pooley and Marion Tupi, where they track the cost of various goods over the last 50 or 100 years in blue-collar wages, in white-collar wages, etc. And what do you find? They use time prices, because if I take your wage, Pierre, and I say, hey, what do you make per hour? And then I track all these goods against an hour of your work, what you'll find out during your entire life is that these goods have got cheaper in time. Like, how many minutes did it take you to earn XYZ? That is the history of all this. So again, there's been this explosion of demand and interest in AI. It will get used. And by the way, it always proliferates. Why? Because the price goes down, and with lower prices, you always demand more. And we call that the study of economics. And that's why it ain't different this time.
Yeah. Exciting. Cole, let's pivot, because I think we spent a lot of time talking about, why this period is in question, why there's so much reason to think about pivoting. And looking at portfolios and recalibrating, are we still in a period of U.S. structural dominance, or are we, are the early stages of a global capital rotation already underway?
Yeah, we would argue for the latter. But let me just add one other thing we haven't talked about.
Please.
Let's go back to history. So I live in Phoenix, Arizona. So, you know, oil is at $147 a barrel on WTI in July of 08. So if I was a Canadian, when would I have gone out to buy my second home in Phoenix, Arizona? Then what'd you get? You got the loonie at par with the dollar. Okay. What a great time to do that. Now, why was that going on? Two major factors. One, commodities had ripped over the prior 10 years. And when commodities rip, the loonie gets to be one of the dominant currencies from a price action perspective over that period. Second part to that, capital flows to U.S. equities were becoming weaker and weaker and weaker. And so when you think about the capital account versus the current account of the U.S. economy, the capital account is losing money, and therefore normally what is a surplus for us became, you know, money going away. You add that together, and that's where the dollar had its low. Now, the tech bubble broke in March of 2000. Quick fact check, just so everyone's on the same page. The S&P actually peaked a few months later, just so we're, you know, not making sure that we don't all think that, like, the S&P peaked the same day it didn't. It peaked in June of that year. But what happened was for about 2 years, the dollar actually stayed pretty strong. And the dollar began to decline in 02. And within 6 years, it was flat on its back. I'll never forget seeing the euro at $1.50 and the pound at $2. I mean, that's insane compared to where we're at today.
Yeah.
I only point that all out is because when you go from absolute strength and American, you know, American exceptionalism and just myths and, you know, stuff like that, you're going to go to some point where people are going to make fun of you and mock you. I'll never forget being in, say, Switzerland in 2010 and being at a CFA event there. And I remember this guy with this great ascot, you know, he's sitting there, we're talking to him and, you know, we say, oh, you know, this is just our politics. And, you know, Bo Simpson was going on at the time to sequester our spending. And,
right.
And I said, you know, this is like pretty normal and it's annoying, but. And, you know, here's this Swiss guy like, oh, you funny Americans. Oh, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, so again, but that's when American exceptionalism was like nothing. Like there was no such thing. And so I just keep that in mind. Keep that in mind that what you perceive to be dominance and strength is psychological in nature. They tend to come with markets. So, yes, we think the dominance has changed. But even in U.S. markets, something I highlight to people, in other eras where the S&P has done poorly, say like the 1970s, and say the 2000s, bad periods for the S&P.
The lost decade.
Correct, the lost decade or lost decades. One was a negative return in the 2000s, negative real return. But in the 1970s, it was a negative real return era.
Yeah,
nominal returns that were okay, like call it mid-single digits. Okay, and so in those eras, that doesn't
coming out of that post Nifty 50 period.
Correct. Well, 69 was a bear market to start off the decade.
Right.
And then you had the Nifty 50, the really only thing that happened the whole decade of excitement. And once that got crushed, the 74 bear market was a nasty bear market, as they would say. So that didn't mean every stock did poorly, though. So you think about it, this is a composition issue. The S&P has a composition problem. What are some of its composition problems? Well, if you take tech, I take communication services stocks that were the old tech stocks. I take consumer discretionary stocks that were old tech stocks. We got about half the S&P 500 in technology stocks. Okay, that's higher than it was in 2000 outright. The hyperscalers on their own are about 25% of the S&P 500. So does that mean you can't find good opportunities to make stocks in the other 50% of the stock market? No.
Right.
In fact, if you go back and look at the 70s or the 2000s, you know, it wasn't a bad time to own energy stocks. And you made a lot of money, but if you owned the average stock or you know, owned a passive form or just tried to be broad, diversification is for people that don't know anything. That's the point of it, right? You don't want to have to know anything.
Sure.
It might not help.
Yeah. I mean, right now, you know, people are actually talking widely about the fact that in the indexing world anyway, they're talking about the fact that, you know, the S&P 500 has been flat and... But if you look at the equal weight index, it's got a whole different composition, right?
There's a whole different game going on.
Yeah.
That's true. Now, again, it's interesting. I mean, we talked about the SaaSpocalypse. The index was pretty untouched by that. Because what you had going on is while $1 trillion of market cap came off the SaaS businesses, you had $1 trillion of market cap show up in other businesses.
It's rotating. Exactly. It's in movement.
There's a big
rotation. Transition, right?
And if I, there might be, you know, today...
But that makes me really worry about investors at large who have everything in the S&P 500. They haven't diversified away from that index.
I mean, it doesn't make me worry for them because, I mean, for you or our investors, Pierre, that's something we can profit, right? I mean, you know, in the 98 meeting, Buffett made a great quote. He's talking about Jack Welch. And he said, what if you had 500 Jack Welches using the S&P 500? So they're going to compete with each other and returns are going to go down because they're so smart. And he stops and goes, which reminds me, the secret to life is weak competition. And so I am so glad people have bought this. I'm so glad they believe in this. Why? Because if they didn't, it would be a lot tougher to be an investor doing what, say, our investors are doing, for example. That'd be way tougher. What if this is a great value year and there's a bunch of smart value people and they're all really good and they've all done really well? Wow, that would suck. Because I got to be way smarter as a value person, and I don't want to have to be that smart.
Well, Cole, you and what you do are in a minority.
Well, it's because we're kind of degenerate when we come to this. We love it. I mean, we're degenerates that love this, and I say degenerate because you know we love the details of this. We love the opportunity it creates, etc. And as I'm sure your listeners can tell, we really believe in what we're doing because we got our capital sitting there too. I mean, this is my name, it's my livelihood, and I'm terribly passionate and excited about what our investors get to do in the future executing this opportunity.
Tap dancing.
Yeah, like Buffett says, tap dancing to work.
I love it. You've been saying recently that we're in a long-term U.S. dollar bear market.
Mm-hmm.
If this is fundamentally a capital flow reversal, what specific signals would confirm that the rotation out of U.S. assets has structurally begun?
Yeah, I mentioned that commodity eras tend to be good for the Canadian dollar. Inversely, it's bad for the dollar. So, I mean, look at the move in gold, look at the move in silver, and full disclosure, we don't own anything that, you know, produces gold or silver. I'm just using it as a picture of you're seeing these big squeezes in these big commodities. Now, the biggest commodity in the world, just so we're on the same page, is this three-letter name. It's called OIL, oil, okay?
Right.
And so that's the biggest commodity if you look at the GSCI commodity basket and things like that. But you're seeing this go off in other commodities. So I look at this as like it seems strange. It seems weird. Yeah, compared to what we had seen, for most of my adult life, it seems weird and strange. But in the scheme of a commodity move in a bull market, commodities, it's not very strange. You will go through a rotational bull market. So, you know, silver takes off from $20 or $30 to goes to $120, backs off to $70. I think it's at $90 right now. Yeah, it might settle at 60, but it ain't going back to 20 or 30. That's just the way this is. And so we're going to go through these rotational bull markets in commodities that we've already started to see. And the one that will really upset the apple cart is always usually oil. And, someone could say that could be late cycle. Cool, I don't care. As long as it comes, it's very profitable for our investors. But I think that's what we're going to go see. And what that will do, on the margin, Americans will pay more for what goes on, because they're getting that from something outside the United States. You know, as an example, we're trying to give you a practical view of this. The Permian is peaking and will begin to decline from a lack of investment, okay? And so as we go forward, us being this big exporter, that becomes marginally less so because we're going to produce less. So as global demand continues to grow for oil, we're going to be in a situation where we're just a smaller percentage of the market share. And who is more in control of that oil market will be governments of the rest of the world, right? Because that's what OPEC Plus is. And so I always tell people, listen, if their governments are in control of the price, what are their governments' incentives? Because most governments in the world are borrowing too much money. And the answer is they're going to want high prices in the long run. It's kind of what government wants if they're in a business.
Yeah.
It's like if they sell you cigarettes and they tax it, guess what they want? High cigarette prices, okay? And so we think that's going to follow a very normal curve, but that just ultimately doesn't benefit the dollar. You know, if I had to kind of give you a practical way of thinking about that, it just means that non-dollar assets will probably, in dollar terms, will probably have like a 1-2%, return benefit over the next 10 years off and on, right? It's not all going to come at once, but you'll be able to look back and say, if I had to translate what the dollar benefit was to be in non-dollar assets, it's probably 1-2%. If I'm wrong, maybe it could be as high as 3%, depending on the kind of currency market you're dealing in. But again, we don't touch currencies for the purpose of betting on currencies. We only touch currencies to settle stock trades in businesses we want to own. And therefore, I don't sit around much in the day and saying, huh, you know, I wonder if the Canadian dollar is going to bounce to, you know, 85 cents on the dollar here in the next 6 months. I mean, I spend no time thinking about that because that doesn't tell me what kind of business I'm going to buy with that currency. And therefore, it's a moot point to us.
Interesting. That's very revealing. I think, you know, it's very pragmatic when you stop and think about it to take it that, you know, to have that angle on that, because currency, you know, tends to be a big discussion, and hedging tends to be a big discussion around that. Whether, you know, if you're going to be an international investor, do you do it hedged or unhedged?
Hedging's very expensive, though. I mean, as everybody knows.
Yeah, it eats into your returns.
It eats into your returns. So, again, the idea behind hedging would just be like you're reducing your volatility. But
yeah,
when you're a stock market investor, you don't want to reduce your volatility. You get paid for volatility. That's how you make your money as an investor in liquid securities. So I would say I'm generally not a fan of hedging. I can see the use case. I look at it as, it, you know, there are exceptions to the rule. Like the old saying is, the young man knows the rules, the old man knows the exceptions. So I think there are exceptions, but, you know, there's just not very many, exceptional moments to exact that.
Cole, in your international value outlook, you describe a shift from narrative-driven mythos investing to economic reality logos. Your missive was aptly titled From Mythos to Logos. Where are you seeing that transition most clearly outside the U.S., and what are investors possibly still getting wrong about international equities?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of hindsight bias, right?
There is. I'll just use this as a picture into the United States for your listeners, just to give them a sense. So let's say you walk into the average wealth management firm in America, and, you know, that could be a big firm, that could be a big bank, that could be anything, or it could be a small advisor, you know, RIA, et cetera. And you say to them, okay, hey, what do you do in non-U.S. equities in general? It is not uncommon for that advisor to explain to you they do nothing. Nothing in non-U.S. equities. Now, why? Because to your point, the rearview mirror says, what a foolish thing you could do. So we're still really early on in that story, back to the capital flows idea, where the average U.S. investor has not even begun to adventure outside of their own borders to invest. And the way these things work is you go from, you know, I remember when I got in the business back in 2006, one of the big funds at that time was BlackRock Global Allocation. That was a massive fund, well used here in the United States, and not to be critical of the fund. I mean, they'd done well and people rewarded them with capital. And so that was a very common way for U.S. investors to participate in two things, non-U.S. equities and commodities, okay? Now, that went from being one of the most owned funds in America to, you know, by the time you get in, you know, deep into a bull market like this, people don't even know what that fund is. If you go to someone who's been in the business for 5 years, if you said, hey, have you ever used BlackRock Global Allocation? They'll be like, I never heard of the fund before. Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny? Like, that was a big deal when I got in the business. And so, again, it just shows you the psychology can change a lot over 10-year periods. So how I look at this from a Lagos perspective is I think there was one good thing that has changed outside the United States that adds to the idea of the Lagos. It's not everywhere, but stock buybacks are now a tool being used from a capital allocation perspective that used to be thought of as like, oh, that's like an American thing to do. But like only Americans can pull out their calculator and figure out if you take out 5% of shares, what it does to the company. I mean, it's crazy to say that, but people believe that. And so now with buybacks being more prevalent, you're seeing this capital discipline show up in places like Canada, in places like Europe, for example, in their banks. Now, where can we not see that fully? We see it somewhat in places like Japan, but not fully trusted. I'll give you a quick example of this. We own Subaru. Full disclosure, everyone, I am not a Subaru car customer. I would never drive a Subaru.
Right.
But I'm a pragmatist, and I recognize that there is a devout customer base that loves Subarus. They tend to be folks in the Pacific Northwest of America, in our case, that shop at REI, or people in the Northeast of the United States. And those are people that shop at L.L. Bean. Okay, so it's like an outdoor customer. I had to say politically he's a little more left than most. But again, there's just super devout customer base. Okay, this is a company that carries most of their market cap in cash. So let's go back to the taper tantrum. Big scare on autos at that time, for example. So let's just say I had the chance. I don't, but let's say I had the chance to sit in the boardroom of Subaru back then. I would have turned to everyone and said, hey, listen, we can't predict the future. We don't know what Donald Trump's going to do. But you know what? Are we ever going to get more fear around our business than this? And are we ever going to get better prices than this when we're sitting on 100% of our market cap in cash? You know what I think we do? I think we just damn the guns and we go after this and let's go buy back as much stock as we possibly can in the regulatory framework. And then let's assert what goes on after that. But we probably can't suck up more than 20% of the stock. But if we do and the future's bright, we might win the game. We might win the game. Okay. Now, that's how we think as investors are just humans. And we see that going on in Canada. We see that going on in Europe, for example. If I had to give you some examples, we love what Tamarack Valley is doing with their buyback. We love what UniCredit's done with their buyback. I love what Barclays is doing in their buyback, for example. I cannot figure out the capital allocation at Subaru other than knowing they've bought back some stock. But they gotta be more boldly passionate. If they make these great cars and they have these addicted customers, the future's bright, my friends, and let's go take advantage of it. So that's added to this argument of Lagos because that's just self-correction. You're just treating your investors better. But from the investor perspective, we're gonna turn over to a point where there will be this idea of, interesting, these businesses did not trade at stupid prices. And they did good things with their capital, and they produced adequate returns for me, an investor. And, oh, by the way, if we got too excited about dollar assets, I might get a kicker in the currency over a period of time. And we could wake up at a future point in 5 years where investors say, you know what? I might just prefer that for a while. Okay, that's where the Lagos would change to recognize that businesses are doing what they need to meet their financial needs. So it's like these companies are going from just being this speculative idea in their minds, or like, oh, that's outside the United States, no one makes good money there, to this idea of, well, it's more like buying an investment product. They're fitting my needs. And that's where we just came out of in the S&P. You were buying a return. You think nothing different of it. And that's going to go away over time in comparison.
It's really interesting to see how, you know, I love the way you describe it. I mean, I love the way that you describe it from narrative driven to economic reality, because really, if you stop and, you know, without having been steeped in, you know, the insight that you've gathered over the last number of years, if you stop and look back, it's so true that we've become wrapped up in the storytelling and not paying attention to the reality of what's going on behind the scenes. You know, it finally dawned on investors that this fiscal policy coming out of Europe as a result of what happened last year in the tariff mess, the tariff chaos, is real and it's structural. And it's going to translate into serious, I mean, you know, sizable economic payoff for European companies, as you know, Europe, and that same thing is happening. The same trend is happening in Canada as well.
Yeah,
in the defense sector, in the resource sector. I mean, the amount of spending that is going on in Europe in order to lessen, or in Germany, for example, to lessen its dependency on the Eastern Bloc for its energy, on Russia for energy, to reshape its entire energy policy from, you know, this 10-year post-nuclear mess that they got themselves into.
Yeah.
Those are things that take 5 and 10 years. Those are things now you can look 5, 10 years out and you can actually calculate what does that mean?
Yeah.
What does that additional spending by the governments of Europe mean for those businesses?
It's self-help. I mean, you know, I think of it as like, you know, we go to God and be like, God, I really need you to help me out. You know, I'm like in a tough spot here. And God's like, dude, if you quit shooting yourself in the foot, I don't think I have to do much here. Okay. To your point from Europe. So Europe had been...
I mean, that's happening in Canada too, right? But let's talk about Europe and then we'll talk about Canada.
They're very similar, okay? So if someone said, you know, prescribe me, you know, what a government should be doing, saying, okay, the old playbook didn't work, so let's throw the old playbook out, and let's ask ourselves how we make ourselves very attractive for capital. How do we make ourselves very attractive for businesses to do more? How do we make ourselves attractive for cheap energy, right? All those things, those are all very similar. So for example, in the Canadian context, we call it pipelines. Like, that's the big discussion. Mm-hmm. And so you've gone from a government regime that hated, and I mean hated, the idea of Canada's energy, other than the fact that, like, if I go to anyone in Alberta and be like, hey, how much tax revenue you send it back east? They all got the number.
Oh, yeah.
They all got that number in head. So that was just the economics of it. Okay. Now, that being said, in Europe's case, it was this, okay, Europe has an aged population that will decline, not dissimilar to the rest of the West, might I add. But they all looked and said, okay, someone else is going to fight our war. In many cases, like, the United States will step up for us. And now that's gone. So what are they doing? They're having to quit shooting themselves in the foot and do it themselves. Now, one thing I will highlight in all these things, it's all government spending. It is all government spending. So what's weird to me is, like, our government, our exceptionalism, because of our dollar, has been our ability to borrow at obscenely high levels. 7% of our GDP has been in deficit for years now, looking back to the pandemic. That's not normal. That can't sustain, but it's been able to go for a while. The reason why economic growth in the United States of America has been so strong relative to other places is because we're just spending so much more largesse. And now we have these other governments finally stepping up. Now, you know, think about just saying that from these global governments' perspective. We are going to have to reap what we sow. And what we are going to have to reap is, this will translate to higher demand today, but that will come back in the form of higher prices in the future. And if anyone disagrees with that, I think you're wrong. Our investors think mm-hmm. you're wrong. But you're right. The governments across the world to figure this out, and the history argues that they will do whatever causes the government and their process of doing business and commerce and politics to succeed. They aren't there for investors. Now, one other thing I'll add for Canada, and this is coming up here recently.
Yeah.
As many of you know, we were involved in the Meg-Synovus merger, okay? And it taught us a lot about the merger and acquisition rules in Canada. So from a policy perspective, are there things Canada can do to quit shooting itself in the foot? Yes. Yes, there are things they can do. More investor protections are always good. So if you say, hey, here are our rules, there shouldn't be anything that's like in between the lines that you had to, as a foreigner, know that that might not be the exact rule, that you shouldn't have to go to a lawyer and be like, it doesn't say it. They're like, well, it doesn't say it, but, you know, it is what it is, right? Why? Because all the rules should be written in a way that it's there to protect the 100-share investor or the smallest investor. The smallest Canadian investor, might I add. So we think right. a lot about what are things that Canada can do to improve what they're doing in such a way where it creates this high accountability, high responsibility, high amount of capital flows to the country. We're seeing this play out. I mentioned how great the capital allocation is Tamarack Valley. They have asked their shareholders to approve a poison pill provision where we give the board the right to set a price and how many shares we have the right to buy if a suitor comes to try to take them out. Now, why are they doing this? Is a question that should come up.
Right.
And I would say, you know what? The Clearwater play, which is where their dominant asset pool sits in, which is where all this water flooding, incredible things that they're doing is, the Clearwater needs to be consolidated. And we all know that. So why in the heck would we stop a suitor from consolidating the Clearwater? That is absolutely foolish. And because of that, it begets the question of why would we want to do this? Now, if you're in a mining business and you're creating your first mine, there is an economic argument to say we don't want someone to swoop into the public market and steal the company out for our first mine before it's producing something real. Okay. That kind of poison pill, but I would say if our mine's going to end in 2028, our provision needs to end in 2028, because that way the reason for it would be ending also. We are not building a mine at Tamarack Valley Energy, just so everyone's on the same page. We have these incredible assets that are producing incredible economics, producing higher returns on invested capital than people thought, and growing the reserves of this business wonderfully. And to come in and ask the shareholders at a juncture like this to take a poison pill and trust a board, which I haven't done a lot of looking into their board, but let me just tell you the quick history of Canadian E&P boards. They're loaded with people that lost money for 20 years in the space. Okay? They're all the people that wasted a bunch of money in the 2010s and mm-hmm. ruined investor returns, and everyone has that uncle that bought the stock they shouldn't have in Calgary, okay? And so I just say that because they do not have a track record that we can just say, carte blanche, we're just going to trust you. There are people I trust in Canada with my capital. Adam Watrous is one of those folks. I would say yep. International Petroleum, Will Lundin and the Lundin family, that's a group of people that I trust with my capital. There are other people that are on that list, but I just pointed out because they've earned that trust. They've compounded capital. They've been a great steward. And the idea we just trust any Tom, Dick, or Harry board member at a Canadian E&P, you know, trust is earned. I would forgive them for what they did, but that doesn't mean we should naturally trust them. You have to earn that trust. And so watching that being handed out, that is bad policy for Canada. I would not recommend other companies adopt that. When I talk to people back in Toronto, they're like, oh, this is like normal here. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Just because it's normal doesn't mean it's good policy for Canada. And if any policymakers say, Cole, I like your idea, call me. I'd love to talk more about it as a foreign investor. But I just pointed out because I think the world of Canada, I think Canada's future is very, very bright. But some of this is just not shooting yourself in the foot, just like we are shooting ourselves in the foot. We're borrowing way too much money in my country. But you know what? No one cares. So I'd rather go to Canada and say, hey, your bright future is attainable. I think ours is a little less, a little more crazy fiscally. Why don't you do more? Because the expectations are so low for Canada, and a lot more could go right for Canada.
That's extremely relevant and interesting, Cole. I you know, it's hard to believe. You know, I was reflecting on the idea, you know, what's happened in Germany, what's happened in Canada, you know, this discussion around, you know, 10 plus years of underinvestment in the oil patch, Germany's choice to abandon nuclear mm-hmm. and opt for, of all things, to opt for coal instead. And I look back and I said, like, what precipitated those decisions? Like, you know, of course, there was climate. There was the whole, you know, climate change
debate.
Argument.
Yep.
Debate. And it, you know, it remains debatable. I'm not against the idea of, you know, cleaner air for the globe and lowering, you know, keeping global warming under control. However, looking back, you know, like if you look at Germany's decision, like I think in Canada, we are in love with the idea that we have this global reputation for being a good guy. And we don't want to.
And you are.
You know, because we. And no, it's true. I think Canada still holds on to that reputation. But I think because we sort of painted ourselves into that corner of overdoing the right thing. Or over ensuring that we're doing the right thing.
Or overdoing
integrity,
the nice thing.
But yeah, the nice thing, exactly. But integrity is integrity. I think when you look at, you know, like Germany's choice to abandon nuclear, it was based largely on the fear of the Chernobyl disaster.
Yeah. Well, by the way, Fukushima when Fukushima happened in Japan, Japan did the same thing. And so the fear of nuclear drove people to use high-grade coal plants.
One movie and one show in the last number of years. One movie was Anthropocene.
Okay.
And it was this fabulous sort of visual display of a film. But in one of the segments, the entire segment is about what's happening in Germany with terraforming coal mining machines tearing up the countryside.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, you're opting for something that is, you know, ESG or it's green, but at the same time, because you don't want to do nuclear, you're tearing up the whole countryside for coal, for lignite. So they've got these gigantic, the biggest machines in the world eating up hillsides, eating up, you know, entire like regions that towns and, you know, towns that have been there for hundreds of years are completely displaced.
Sure.
Like, there's this scene where the people of this particular town have had to completely evacuate because the machines are coming for this, for the lignite.
Yeah.
And you know, their church, which has been there for hundreds of years, if not longer, is demolished.
Yeah.
And then everything. And then on Amazon the other day, I watched a program just briefly about these machines, these same machines, which have, you know, these gigantic, you know, Ferris wheel of scoops.
Yep.
That just eat up entire hillsides at once, you know, thousands and thousands of tons of raw material. I looked at that and I thought that's what you opted for, because your biggest threat was that people were worried about nuclear power, nuclear accidents.
Yeah.
And now look at the position you've put yourself in. You're beholden to Russia for natural gas.
Yeah. Well, you know, we see it here. I mean, so for example, I saw a great picture today. And I think this is a fantastic debate from a policy perspective, from a city planning perspective, things like that. So I'll use Arizona just as a picture. If you went to the state commission that deals with energy policy, if you go to the people that are involved in that, their biggest thing is we want to be the most reliable grid. Okay, now I didn't say the cheapest. I said the most reliable. Okay, well, I think mm-hmm. we're the seventh cheapest, but they pride themselves on being the most reliable. If you need energy, you're going to find it. There's going to be an appropriate price, et cetera. Okay. So as you look at the United States, let's just say we use North American oil and gas. Okay. There's a great chart I saw the other day showing all the places where North American oil and gas is. And so obviously Texas is broadly oil and gas. As you move up, it roughly falls not far off the Rockies all the way up in Canada. And we know where that is in Canada. But one of the other pockets outside that is, you know, just to the west of the Sierra Nevadas in places like L.A. And if your listeners haven't been to L.A. lately, you could still go to L.A. and there's still oil derricks around L.A. Mm-hmm. They're still pumping
all over
out
the
oil.
Place.
It's a vast resource of oil and gas.
Yeah.
Now, they decided that they didn't want that as a dominant industry. But if you go 100 years ago and say, has that ever happened in a place like Huntington Beach? You see these old, really fun pictures where it's like a house is in Huntington Beach and there's oil derricks all over it. Okay. The original
Or even the old photos of Huntington Beach where there was oil rigs right on the beach.
Right on the beach.
Right up to the beach, yeah.
The old pitch for L.A. was like, hey, it's so nice, and by the way, your energy is cheap, and it's a great place to live, and things of that nature. And so, I think about it like that. Like, you know, what is the cost of the energy you're getting? If it's not low, something bad has been decided. Because ultimately, I argue, some people disagree with this, but energy is an infinite good. The question is just what's the cost to extract it?
Mm-hmm.
It's infinite by nature, though. Okay. And so where it's expensive to the consumer, it means someone hasn't wanted you to extract enough of it. Okay. The other thing I think a lot about, you know, on this score is, you know, we've tried to zone and regulate everything. We just have, for better or for worse. There was an interesting article, Neil Ferguson, who I love reading Neil Ferguson's mm-hmm. work. He had posted something on X where a gentleman had written about really city planning and zoning and things of that nature. And he pointed out that when we used to have a lot less rules, the growth of urban areas was far higher. In other words, the city growth, the population growth, things of that nature. What if part of our population problem is whether we like it or not, people recognize that their freedoms are inhibited, therefore they exhibit less freedom in their own personal life, even down to their children? That's not a crazy idea.
No.
It's actually pretty logical, I would say. And so I think about those things from a bigger policy perspective. What if we just tell you, hey, you know what? Do what you think is best. What do we think we're going to find? A lot more freedom of people, a lot more freedom of choice, and a lot more freedom of opportunity, which I would argue is the most important thing for everyone.
And also a lot more, you know, a lot of self-policing or self-regulation.
Correct, because you might want to do what your neighbor thinks is good because they're your neighbor. No, but it's your economic right to do what you want.
So I want to come back. I want to get just touch more on Canada again. You've said we're living in a post-frackers world. I know we touched on it a couple times earlier as sort of a preface to this particular question. You've said we're living in a post-frackers world. What is the core investment thesis behind Canadian oil today? Is it long-lived reserves, slowing U.S. shale growth, geopolitical realignment, or just a simple mispricing of durable assets?
It's a good question. So, let's just use the long life of the oil sands as an example. A little bit of nuance, but I'm going to get into this because it's kind of fun. So when someone comes in to get an appraisal of their assets in the Canadian like oil sand space, By rule and definition, they can book a lot more in reserves, you know, over time. So common is to be 20 years or greater. Now, if you go to look at a Permian asset, which is like a frack well, for example, by definition, whether or not there's a lot of reserve there, it's 7 to 10 years. That's just very common standard. So you got to understand, when you look at the life of these reserves, it's what can be booked based on the asset type. It doesn't mean everything's all true in that. Those are just the rules for surveying and accounting for this. Okay. So I point that out because if you just think about the long life nature of, say, an oil sand asset, it's like buying a bond, right? You're buying a bond in a way. Mm-hmm. And then the coupon payment is just based on the oil price. Right. So it's like a floating rate bond, and the oil price decides what, you know, how high the yield goes. That's how I think about the oil sands as an investor. So what else can get in the way of that? If someone's not good at operating, so their break evens are really high, for example. So I totally stole this and plagiarized this from Adam Watrous. I give him all the credit for it. But since plagiarism's legal, I'll teach you my framework. High reserve life, low break even assets. That's what you want. Okay. Now, that's a general rule. That's the rule. Young man knows the rule. Old man knows the exceptions, like I said earlier. So that's the rule I would follow. So who do we own up there that fits that? Well, Cenovus has long life assets. Strathcona has long life assets. Imperial Oil has long life assets. So as we were analyzing things over the last few years, does that mean it fits perfectly into that framework? No. Tamarack Valley does not have long life assets like that. They are not an oil sands business. But what we find interesting going on there is, A, we got to get involved in it in the spring of 2025, that really scary time that you shouldn't do anything like that. And what we're dealing with is a business that can't book those same reserves, but as they're water flooding, what's happening is the water flooding is producing higher returns on capital than people thought. And the second thing it does is it shows that their reserves are growing. In other words, we're not getting to book the reserves up front, but we're growing our reserves over time. And so how I economically look at their business is I look at the cash we just took in plus the economic value added from new reserves, which tells me what the economic value added was in that process. Is that exceptional? Yeah, it's exceptional to that rule I said. Now, we more recently started buying a new oil sands business, which is International Petroleum. What does International Petroleum fit into? High reserve life, low break evens. They're building an asset called Blackrod. That asset, in 3 years, will have 30,000 flowing barrels of production. But they do about 45,000 barrels. About half that comes in one asset called Suffield, which is kind of a gas dominant. So as we were analyzing their business, we sat down and said, okay, let's take Suffield. We'll back that out of the pie. And then we valued the rest of their oil sands assets with really where we're going in 3 years in that Blackrod asset. Now, Blackrod, just so we're on the same page, can go to 80,000 barrels in the long run. So if I take, their current production oil sands, about 22,000 plus growing 80,000 on Blackrod over time, I'm roughly building Meg there. So Meg just sold off at $54,000 per flowing barrel to Cenovus. And so I kind of have a baseline price at trough oil prices to say, where can I set a standard and a unit of measurement based on Meg and help me try to value a business like International Petroleum? What else do I get at International Petroleum? I said earlier, I think the Lundin family have been a great group of people to steward capital and, as they say in animals, husband the capital for you. And I think Will Lundin thinks a lot like we do, and I was very impressed by their capital allocation. While they're spending all this money to build this asset, what is he doing? He's out buying back stock before they get to go do their pilot. He's trying to take advantage of the market at an apropos time, and we found all that to be terribly interesting. Now, to your point, does that mean that shorter life assets in the Permian aren't attractive to us now? No. 2 years ago, everything I said on those long life assets was all true, and very few people believed it back then. What we think we've seen is there's now a building premium to long life assets. So I think our calculus would say, marginally speaking, long life assets are being more attractively priced relative to short life, which they should have a premium because they actually do reduce the risk because they're the longer term bond versus a shorter duration bond where you got to be more right about the interest rate cycle, for example. Okay. So in that, we think the premium is merited. It's now in place in a way it hasn't been. But someone asked me the other day, said, Cole, what do you find really attractive right now? I said, oh, it's really simple. these stocks have re-rated in such a way where the oil price has stayed kind of the tepid thing in all this. So if I'm trying to sit down and do my calculus in the investment space right now of the E&Ps in Canada or the United States, I think the best bet is torque. Torque being where the oil price change to the higher, to a higher level, what it does on the operating leverage of the business. So higher torque assets are the opportunity relative to anything else right now. And so I'll use International Petroleum. If you're going to have a 30,000 flowing barrel business there in 3 years, and torque would be higher oil prices and how it affects the cash flows of that, do I think that we're going to be valuing these oil sands assets, or maybe, you know, other oil sands assets outside of like a Meg, at $54,000 per flowing barrel? No. No, people were paying a higher market price for that, and therefore the torque, aka the cash flows that come off at these higher prices and how it changes the value of the business, free cash flow could explode in International Petroleum. And I don't think people are necessarily trying to dream. It's still a good time to dream, because we're not at the point where most market participants, whether it be S&P investors or global equity investors sitting in the MSCI world, are really dreaming about these spaces yet.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, you definitely don't want to wait for the catalyst to be right in front of you.
Well, because it's going to be in the stock price right by then. Therefore, you
can't. Yeah, exactly. So you're not getting it at an attractive valuation. I love the that's the first time I've ever heard that, Cole. I love the bond analogy to the oil sands.
Well, I don't think Adam's ever said that, but that's how I think about it. It's like you're buying a long-term bond. And with a variable rate, and the coupon you get paid is just based on whether oil is going higher or whether oil is going lower. Now, the other place you can get benefit from
the floating rate as well. The idea of it being a floating rate bond, not just a
correct,
not a fixed income bond, but a floating rate bond.
if these businesses get more efficient, which has been the history of the businesses, that does improve the underlying yield of the bond over time. So if you have low break evens, and those break evens could come down even more, that improves the yield of the bond. So there's human ingenuity that can actually do it outside the commodity, but the call of spade is spade. The commodity is the easiest way to move that bond payment over time.
And that's where, you know, some Canadian stewards have become, as you mentioned, Adam Waterous, the Lundin family, have become exceptional at finding the capital efficiency across their business and turning that into profits. You know, it's... That's something, by the way, it's pretty, I don't know if I might be wrong in saying this, but, you know, across the Canadian economy, across the Canadian business ecosystem, you know, we've seen more than a few examples of where Canadian leaders, business leaders, have taken something that seems at times mundane. Mm-hmm. And you know, like alchemy, turned it into, you know, turned lead into gold.
I agree. I mean, there's good examples, you know, not far from you. So I'll use a Canadian favorite, and I think it's a truly great Canadian story. What Bouchard did at Couche-Tard.
Yeah, exactly. You took the words right out of my mouth.
It's remarkable. And by the way, we have a very small position in Couche-Tard. We bought it back when the Carrefour, you know, the whole like French food independence, you know, idea was thrown out. And all the quality growth people that own that stock, they vomited that stock up quickly because they were like, oh, I did not buy this as a blue chip to take risk. I beg your pardon. These things are risk-taking assets, okay? Yeah. And so we took that as our first time to get involved. We didn't buy enough. It's business done really well. But here's why I say it. No one was out there worried about the convenience store business at that time, and Bouchard's done a great job. I'll give you another Canadian example. I am a big Jim Pattison fan. Pattison is a great investor, a great capital allocator. He did that originally in the car business. You know, he's done that in other industries. He owns West Shore Terminal, which we don't own. He owns almost half of Canfor, which we don't own. We do own West Fraser Timber, which we hold in common with him. I think very highly of great capital allocation like Jim Pattison. And I've never met him, but the interviews I've seen of Jim, you know, they ask him, Jim, you know, why are you involved in these businesses? And just so simply and so matter-of-factly says, you know, I'm just interested in assets when nobody else wants them. And the truth is, you'd be better off doing that in your investment discipline than trying to run after the excitement all the time. You just save yourself a lot of grief and overpayment.
Simple, but not easy, right?
Correct.
You know, to become a scion of Canadian business. I mean, and there are, you know, there are more than a few.
I agree.
They've all got that more or less in common, is that ability to act when no one wants to. To be a true, like, dyed-in-the-wool contrarian.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, even use what's going on at Lulu. I mean, Chip Wilson,
yeah,
he created a product category. Very impressive. Someone says, I think Chip Wilson's wrong. I'd say, great.
Yeah, can you imagine if...
You go and start a business. You go do that. And then you can say all you want. But so I really appreciate, you know, whether you like him or not, whether you like everything he said over the years, I appreciate Chip Wilson's chutzpah and his ability to just go out and take risk and dream. I mean, that is an incredible thing. It drives the ingenuity and the creativity and really creates a way greater life, a quality of life for all of us. It's such a wonderful thing. It's the natural benefits of commerce and capitalism.
Yeah. Hey, everybody, who doesn't want a pair of yoga pants? Come on. Everybody wants yoga pants.
Best golf shorts in the world, in my opinion.
Yeah,
best golf shorts.
Exactly.
So.
Cole, we've been talking for over 90 minutes now. Are you allowed to talk about your plans for Canada?
Yeah, I could just give a kind of a general overview of what we're up to.
So you're Cole, you're planning to open shop in Canada, open shop to investors in Canada. How's that coming together?
Yeah, it's so we are in the process of registering for what they call an IFM, an investment fund manager, and a PM, obviously a portfolio manager designation. We're doing that with the Ontario Securities Commission, the primary, you know, Securities Commission in Canada for that. So we're in our process waiting for that to finish out. You know, why would we register as an investment fund manager? Because our plan is we'd like to go out and launch, you know, a fund into Canada. So let me just say this, you know, it's kind of from a bigger picture perspective. If you haven't picked this up, I haven't been too subtle about this. I really enjoy going to Canada. I really enjoy doing business in Canada. I really enjoy people in Canada. It's just my bias. It is what it is. And so I look at this as a natural outcropping. I even, you know, again, to the large language model discussion, I went out and asked, I think it was Grok, I asked it to run all the direct flights to Canada. I think, if I remember off the top of my head, I think I have access to 9 direct flights to Canada on either a daily or a multi-weekly basis here from Phoenix, Arizona. Because something else I've learned a lot over the years is Canadians like coming to where I live. So I just say that because, you know, I grew up in Seattle, Washington, numerous times in my life. We went across the border when I was 8 years old. We drove way up into Jasper, came down to Banff. This has been something I've been doing for my, you know, entire childhood. My kids skied a lot at Whistler, you know, as they were growing up. We started some years up in Sunshine Village. I was less traveled in the Eastern time zone of Canada, but as we go forward, I'm there a lot more. And so I just say that because, you know, I've just done this so much that it's pretty fluid from, you know, my personal perspective and also a business perspective. And we just think there's a lot of opportunity to, you know, be a light, show up fresh with different opinions. And whether you like those or not, we're not here to work with everyone. That's not our goal and our purpose. In full disclosure, though, I mean, we will only be accessible directly through financial advisors and institutional investors. So we are, right, won't be a directly accessed, firm from a retail perspective. So, you know, if you were asking me, Cole, how can I get involved? I'd say you need to call your financial advisor. We don't do that kind of work, nor would we want to, because someone could do that better for you and has the regulatory framework to be able to do that for you. So I just say that because we're pretty excited about that. I think it's going to be a very fun thing. I go to the Stampede the last couple of years because the issuers we own up there, but I'm sure I'm going to get to see a lot more of Canada, which will be very fun.
Well, Cole, when that actually comes to pass, welcome to Canada. It's great to have you. I think I'm a fan. We're fans of your work over the last, I think almost 15 years that we've known about you and of you and reading your missives from Smead, from Smead Capital Management. And you can find Smead Capital Management at smeadcap.com. The other thing I want to talk about, just or bring up, shout out to you, is your podcast. What an amazing podcast. I listened to the Crazies.
That was a fun one.
Yeah.
That was totally cool. Amy's book was fantastic. Her book is about the crazy mountains, just so everybody knows. It's a mountain
Montana.
Island in Montana. And it had all this, like, to your point, land use came up, you know, rich versus poor, because these ranchers are poor and these billionaires are coming in that are rich. And it's so interesting to think that, like, the cross section of issues in America are showing up in a random mountain group in Montana. I mean, what a fun story and beautiful. So I'm planning to go up to Big Timber this summer and kind of do my, you know, archaeology and visit town and whatnot. And so the other thing to your listeners, if you have a good book, I mean, let Pierre know. I'm all ears. You know, the last Canadian specific book we did was Standard Imperial, which is the history of Imperial Oil and Exxon's involvement in Canada, which was a great that came out of the University of Calgary Press, if I remember correctly. So, you know, because I have this kind of love and passion for Canada, I'm all ears if people have books they'd like to recommend up there.
Awesome. And Cole, you're sitting in front of the title poster of your podcast, which is A Book with Legs.
Correct.
And I love the opening. I love the premise of your podcast, which is that you're, you know, at Smead Capital, your readers, the idea that, you know, reading expands your mental models. And, you know, reading is something that seems to be, has been in decline since, you know, the internet and since the, you know, emergence of our, you know, our beloved devices.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I would, but real quick on that, because back to my high agency idea with AI. Okay. Let's say someone reads a lot. Do I think they will have more worldly wisdom? Do I think they'll have more framework for thinking? Yes, I do. Okay. So let's think about books. Books are highly accessible. You can go to your public library and go read a book for very cheap, if not free in many cases. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, despite that vast resource out there, Does it matter to most people? And so I think a lot about that. Like, you know, we have these tools that we get. Books are a tool. You know, AI is a tool. But just because they have access to the tool doesn't mean they're going to use the tool and doesn't mean they're going to make great decisions even if they use the tool. So, again, the idea we're going to take humans and make them more than humans, we might just be giving them a new hammer. And the book didn't really change them that much either, other than just making us generally more educated.
You've covered some of the most prolific or most interesting books in your show. So I just wanted to give you a shout out for your podcast because it's an awesome podcast. It's a wonderful podcast to listen to. Cole, thank you so much. Great
having
you.
Thanks so much, Pierre.